This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One person can actually have a fairly big impact if they're willing to be organized and to put the effort into observing things. When you work with small things like insects, you don't actually have to travel that far. You can often find some amazing things in your backyard or in the park next door or something like that.
The most interesting things in life are sometimes right under our noses. I spent part of my Thanksgiving weekend trekking all of 30 feet to speak to my next-door neighbor, John Hafernick, professor of biology at San Francisco State University and the president of the California Academy of Sciences. For today's show on Sea Change Radio, John Hafernick talks about the sudden, mysterious disappearance of many of the world's honeybees, known as colony collapse disorder, as well as a wider pollinator crisis. Then, in the second part of today's show, we discover an ecological opportunity right under our noses. IBM researcher Christine Robson has helped develop a new iPhone application known as CreekWatch, which enables regular folks to help measure the world's water supply by simply visiting their neighborhood parks. This week on Sea Change Radio, the solution next door. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is John Hafernick. He is a professor of biology at San Francisco State University, and he's president of the California Academy of Science. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here, Alex.
We originally discussed bees in our adjacent backyards. It was a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, when there was a lot of press about bees becoming extinct in certain areas of the globe. When that first hit, it was kind of a newsworthy story, and it's kind of faded from the limelight. Can you fill us in on how that story has evolved and what is going on with our world's bee population?
I think there are a couple of things. The thing that made the big splash in 2006 was something that's been called colony collapse disorder, which was a new affliction of honeybees that hadn't been noticed before, but suddenly was turning up in the United States and also Europe. So there was this great concern about honeybee populations and what might be causing this decline. And basically with colony collapse disorder, the bees leave. They just, for some reason, abandon their hives, leaving their brood behind and often the queen as well. So it's a surprising kind of behavior. There's been a lot of research into what causes that, and we still don't know for sure. The likelihood is that it's a combination of things. Probably a combination of different pathogens or parasites that bees have to deal with. Most recently, there's been thought that it might be related to a fungal disease, which is a thing called Nosema, and maybe an interaction with some viruses as well that push the bees to a tipping point and cause them to abandon their hive. But we actually still don't know for sure, and there's a lot of active research trying to figure it out at this point. Now, the other thing that's happened also is the idea that, in general, there's a pollinator crisis around the world. And that results from the loss of habitat that supports pollinators in natural habitats and also in urban and agricultural areas as well. So that deals with more than just honeybees. Often when people think about bees, usually one thing pops in their mind.
Honey.
Right. And we kind of learn that as we're growing up, that's what bees are. But actually, they're are thousands of other species of bees besides honeybees. For the United States, the honeybee isn't native. It was brought over in the 1600s by European colonists and made it out to California about the gold rush times.
And which of the issues is more alarming to someone like yourself, a scientist? Is it the colony collapse disorder with honeybees, or is it the pollinator crisis, which is a little more alarming to you and most people should be aware of?
Well, I think the overall crisis of pollinators is in a more alarming situation. Honeybees are really important as commercial pollinators of agricultural crops, and we move them around and do all those sorts of things. But if the honeybee was to really collapse, we could probably fill in with native bees, if we were clever in how we structured our agricultural systems and so on. But if the native bees and butterflies and flies and other things that pollinate plants art around or the diversity has been lost, then we've got a lot less flexibility in doing that. So this is something that affects not only agricultural systems, but our native ecosystems as well, which are linked to the pollination services that are provided by these pollinators that make it possible for plants to set seeds and continue.
Can you think of any examples of urban renewal projects that have actually helped a population flourish?
Well, I've done a lot of work in the Presidio of San Francisco, and one of the goals of the Presidio Trust that runs the Presidio has been to try to restore urban natural habitats in the Presidio, which of course was a large army base for many years. And so they're going in and trying to restore sand dune habitats, creekside habitats, et cetera, in the Presidio. And what we're finding is that in many cases, if you build it, they will come. That is, if you restore the habitat and if you have a source nearby of the kinds of organisms that would normally inhabit those kinds of habitats, that they'll find them, establish themselves, and you can have a relatively flourishing interaction between native plants and animals in those kinds of situations. So, for instance, we now have 65 species of bees in the Presidio of San Francisco that we know still survive there, which is pretty good for an urban area, and it's only a slice of San Francisco.
Do you think that is common to most cities, or is it the fact that it's been studied so closely and by experts like yourself?
Well, there's a lot that we don't know about the diversity of bees or other things in urban areas. The tendency for people like me has been to try and find some way to get a ticket to somewhere far away to study something interesting. So my old major professor, Jerry Powell, used to say that no one would study anything within 1,000 miles of where they live.
Well, that's kind of like why we're having this discussion right now. I talk to people all over the world, but sometimes some of the more interesting conversations are a stone's throw away.
That's right. And some of the more interesting things that you can study are often a stone's throw away as well. So it's a little bit hard to know in general what the patterns are across the world, even across the country. Even the idea of a pollinator crisis is something that many of us believe is true, but we don't actually have a lot of hard data on a whole variety of species because it's relatively difficult to get that kind of information. But there's some people that are trying to change that now, to try and come up with ways that we can measure the health of pollinators, for instance, in urban areas and other areas around the country. Something called the Great Sunflower Project that my colleague Gretchen LeBoon at San Francisco State University has started. And what she's done is to send seeds of sunflowers to people all around the country. And I forget how many people she's gotten involved now. It's literally tens of thousands of people who've responded. And what they're asked to do is to plant a sunflower in their garden and then to spend a little bit of time regularly observing the sunflower and seeing how many bees come to that sunflower in a particular period of time. The idea being that if pollination systems are in pretty good shape, then you won't have to wait very long and you'll see a bee coming to sunflowers, since bees love sunflowers.
Is this still an active program if listeners wanted to get involved in it?
It is, and they could go to their favorite search engine and search for the Great Sunflower Project or something like that, and it would come up.
Well, we can link to it on seachangeradio.com. So.
Right.
Well, let's get back to the bees. In terms of the honeybees, first reaction humans inevitably have is, am I going to be paying more for my honey?
Right.
Has that occurred since, I remember this is maybe 2006, we first started hearing stories about that. Have there been any increases in world honey prices?
You know, I don't know exactly what the world honey market is like. My perception is it hasn't had a big effect on the prices of honey, but it potentially could have a big effect on other kinds of products that we may not think about. Almonds, for instance. In California, the almond orchards rely almost exclusively on honeybees for pollination. If you've ever driven down I-5 in February, the orchards are in full bloom, and they're stuck out there in the middle of no place where it's been bladed off, and there are very few other kinds of pollinators that can be there except the commercial honeybees that are brought in. They're trucked in specifically to pollinate those almond groves. And that's pretty much the way we run a lot of our agriculture. these days in terms of bee-pollinated crops.
But are those commercial beehives also going into colony collapse as well?
It's probably a bigger problem for commercial hives than it is for hobbyist hives, although both of them have been affected.
Walk us through what a colony collapse would be like in a commercial beehive.
Well, basically what happens is that the hive starts declining in numbers, and usually it's a problem at about this time of the year, in the fall, early winter, when the bees are getting prepared to overwinter and storing honey and things like that. And they're also under the greatest stress because the times are changing, the cold weather is setting in, and so on.
And do they go to find another queen, or where do they go? Have we found that out
yet? Do they go? Well, we don't know for sure.
They haven't been popping up in other hives, or have we tagged these bees from commercial hives and then seen if they've come to neighboring hives, et cetera?
Yeah, normally they wouldn't be allowed in another hive. The bees in it can tell who belongs to which hive by the smell that they have. They each have a colony odor that they can recognize. So if a bee comes into a hive that it doesn't belong in, then it'll normally be attacked by the other bees. On the other hand, if the colony isn't strong, then other bees can sometimes come in and steal honey from them because they're not strong enough to fight them off. The funny thing about colony collapse disorder is it doesn't seem to have robber bees coming in either, which suggests that the bees are able to sense that there's something wrong with the hive. And
what would they be trying to rob?
Well, they try and rob the honey.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, it's a lot easier if somebody's already stored all the honey away from you and you can just fly in and tank up.
Sail on. Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on. You're gonna keep on sailing. Tell you lose your happy home.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Sea Change Radio. I'm Alex Wise. I'm talking to John Hafernick, the president of the California Academy of Sciences and a professor of biology at San Francisco State University. So this is a pretty distressing occurrence in a lot of ways, but what are some of the positives that have come from the alarms being sounded in the honeybee world?
Well, I think there's a lot more realization now on the part of environmentalists and the public at large of how important bees are and other pollinators are. So that's a good thing. You have to know that first before you can focus on helping out with environments for bees and other pollinators. And there's been a big push in various areas to try and perhaps rethink the way that we do agriculture, rethink the way that we do urban gardens, etc., to try and take advantage of the services that our native bees and other pollinators can provide. So Claire Crimmin at UC Berkeley across the bay has been looking at ways that native bees can be used more in agricultural pollination by thinking about how you structure the areas off to the side of an agricultural field or intercropping different kinds of plants within an agricultural field and so on to try and take advantage of the diversity that we have around us. Garden Frankie, also at UC Berkeley, has been an advocate of urban bee gardens, sort of changing the way that we think about doing our gardening. Instead of it just being a place where we can go and enjoy beautiful flowers or beautiful vegetation, to also think about it as a place that can be an enhancement for biodiversity, in this case for bee diversity, where you can think about what you plant in your backyard, providing plants that bees will visit, and also, importantly for our native bees, thinking about where they might be nesting as well. And that might be leaving a little open space in the ground someplace or putting up some pieces of wood with holes in them that can be nesting sites for native bees or things like that.
And so you've been an advocate to exposing children to nature early, and in particular, there's been an alarming lack, in your opinion, in terms of the insects and studying things like the bee population. How do you think that could be used more effectively to get young people to appreciate all parts of nature?
Young people are curious by nature, and that's their job, is to be curious as they're growing up and observant. And they're often intrigued by small things that are down at their level. So I think it's a real opportunity for them to learn about a variety of different kinds of things that happen in the natural world. But one of the things that I've been concerned about is that as the world is becoming more and more an urban place for humans to live, the majority of humans now live in cities, whereas that wasn't true in the last century or so, that our children are growing up separated from nature. They don't experience it as a part of their normal lives. And I think it's really important if we're going to be successful in conserving biodiversity, the natural processes in the natural world, that it's our children are going to have to be the ones to promote that. They're going to be the ones that carry the flag onward. And they're only going to do that if they appreciate it, if they know about it, if it's meaningful to them. It doesn't matter if it's critically important. If that's not a part of their world, they may not consider it important.
So they don't all have to become entomologists, but as long as they become a little more conscious of the world around them.
Exactly. They're conscious of the world around them and be hungry for information about it, I think, and appreciate it and maybe wowed by it, see those amazing things that are part of the natural world. And when you work with small things like insects, you don't actually have to travel that far. You can often find some amazing things in your backyard or in a park next door or something like that. But I think it's really important that we think about how we structure our urban environment so that the children and adults as well can have those kinds of experiences, that it's not just a paved-over place for a basketball court, but there also are places for natural areas, natural vegetation, and so on, where they can experience some of these things. When I take kids on nature walks, one of the things I've observed is that a lot of them are uncomfortable if they get off the sidewalk. That, you know, life for them is staying between the lines of the sidewalk or an asphalt trail or something like that. They're very uncomfortable getting off onto a dirt path or something like that. And
they're well trained not to get hit by cars.
I guess they're well trained, but I think
maybe overly trained. Huh?
Maybe overly trained. I mean, I grew up as a boy in a town in central Texas where most of my day was spent running around and checking out vacant lots and amazing my parents by the strange things that I could bring back to my house. And I think it's harder and harder for kids to do that now for a variety of reasons. I mean, we tend to be worried about our children in urban environments that they're going to run into threats if they're allowed to just run out into a park or someplace like that unsupervised. And certainly that's something we all are worried about. But it also means that their world is a different place for them because of that.
Children can make us curious just like they are.
It's absolutely true.
And that's true for a lot of what people can do in their day-to-day observance of nature. Some of the more interesting things are a lot closer than you may think.
Well, and one person can actually have a fairly big impact if they're willing to be organized and to put the effort into observing things. So there's an amateur butterfly person in San Francisco, Liam O'Brien, who a few years ago dedicated himself to trying to document the distributions of all the species of butterflies that occur in San Francisco. And he's been able to come up with amazing new records for San Francisco because he's out in the field a lot. That's his passion, to go out and to document what's there.
And if we have that happening in many major metropolitan areas where all these universities are that could fund people doing these things, or somebody who's just passionate about it, who's an amateur butterfly lover,
exactly,
then we actually can start getting some real conclusive data in terms of the numbers of breeds and patterns and migratory patterns and things like that.
Really what we need are ways to look at patterns and changing patterns. And that requires gathering data over a fairly large landscape, over a period of years to be able to see how things are changing. I mean, we anticipate we're going to see changes in distributions due to global warming. And there also is already a lot of good evidence for that from butterflies and from some other species. But you really have to track things over a number of years, and you have to do it methodical way in order to be able to see those patterns. And we were talking about the potential of using iPhone apps and things like that for recording it. And I think that means that you literally could have an army of volunteers and amateurs around the country who were focused on particular groups that they were expert in, butterflies, bees, whatever it might be, birds, of course, are another group that a lot of people spend time watching and enjoying, that with that kind of combination of technology and passion from the people who are involved, we could actually be gathering a lot of information that could allow us to answer some questions about how things are changing, whether things are improving, whether they're getting worse, whether they're staying the same. You really have to have data to answer those questions. And data are often the things that we're light on, at least data that span the test of time, as it were, and are repeated over and over again.
John Hafernick, president of the California Academy of Science, professor of biology at San Francisco State University. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees, the flowers and the trees, and the moon up above, and the thing called love. Baby, the thing called love.
My next guest on Sea Change Radio is Christine Robson. She's a researcher at IBM's Almaden Research Center in their mobile computing division. She's the creator of an iPhone app called CreekWatch. Christine, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Tell us about CreekWatch. What is CreekWatch?
CreekWatch is a project with an iPhone application so that any person who passes by a creek or a stream can do something to help their watershed that just takes a couple of moments and can really make an impact to the environment. It's a crowdsourcing application where you walk up to a creek or stream, maybe while you're on a morning jog or a bike ride, and you take a look at the stream, you see if there's any trash in it, you see how full the stream is and if the water is flowing. And you just take a picture, note that in your iPhone, and send it off to our database. And the water control boards and environmental program managers can access the data, and they use it for planning cleanup programs, for planning water management, for all of the environmental programs in your area.
Christine, can you tell us how this project got started?
We got started doing CreekWatch because we wanted to find a project that people could get involved with around the world that would help with our Smarter Planet initiative. You know, we really wanted to get people involved with their environment. And water is such a big global issue, you know, clean, fresh water, access to it, remaining resources. This is such a critical issue around the world, and that's where we felt that we could make the most impact by getting people more aware of their watersheds, more involved with their watersheds through a mobile crowdsourcing application. And that's how we really conceived CreekWatch. Certainly in San Jose, watching the creeks dry up every summer, you know, worrying about water shortages and water rationing, we're keenly aware in our lab of the impact of diminishing freshwater supplies and pollution in freshwater sources.
Christine, I know this is a new project, but what kind of data have you collected thus far?
So we've been working with the City of San Jose on a beta testing program with the stormwater program in San Jose. And we've had some really great anecdotes from our users, you know, going out into the field. A lot of them, you know, they take their family and they make it an educational trip for the kids, you know, learning to make scientific observations using their iPhone, you know, contributing data that really matters and is really helpful to scientific programs. A lot of other people have made a game of it, you know, driving down a creek, trying to find where the creeks are and spot them. You know, normally you just drive right over your water and you don't think about it, but trying to actually see when there's a sign and it says you're passing a river, you know, people pull over, they take a photo, you know, they're exploring their neighborhoods to look for water. And that's just been a really great use of CreekWatch. It's actually really interesting to look through the data points. You can see some areas, just looking at the pictures, you can see some areas especially in the middle of the city, that have a lot of trash, on some areas up in the mountains that may not have trash, but you can see that they've stopped flowing in the middle of the summer, and maybe now in October some of the new data points are starting to show that the water is picking up again. It really paints a nice picture of the watershed to be able to browse through the data like that.
What kind of time frame are you expecting for this to make an impact?
Well, we're already having impact in San Jose, which is where we did our beta test. The San Jose city is already using the CreekWatch data to plan trash pickup programs in the area, and it really helps them get a picture of where the areas that need cleanup the most are. You know, as I said, it's very difficult for the city to be everywhere at once, covering this huge watershed, and having people on the ground to tell them where they see the worst trash areas is really helpful for prioritizing cleanups. As we go forward, we're hoping to see some more longitudinal data where we can see the filling and emptying of the creeks seasonally over the year, and use that data for larger trash and pollution planning and for water management planning. We've also been reached out to by groups across the U.S. and the world since launching. A lot of people are really interested in using this data. And fortunately, we designed the application with a worldwide view in mind. So there's no sign-up that any government needs to do to get involved with this. They just need to have people submit data, and anyone can download the data at creekwatch.org so they can begin using it immediately. So we're curious to see what use people find of this data in other places outside of California and in the rest of the world.
What do you think CreekWatch and projects like this mean for communities?
One thing that we'd really like with CreekWatch is to empower citizens and citizen scientists to go out and do something to help their environment. And if you have an iPhone, you can download the CreekWatch application and spend a couple of seconds taking a photo of your creek and submitting some data that is really important to water management. And if you don't have an iPhone, at least you can go to the website and take a look at some of this data and be more aware as you're walking by these creeks and streams of the impact that humans have on the environment and how trash in the creeks really is flowing into your watershed and your drinking water.
There's no ads, and it's a free app, Christine. So what is in it for IBM beyond it being part of IBM's Smarter Planet initiative?
From our perspective, we really like to see more people participating in crowdsourcing.
And for our listeners, crowdsourcing is a relatively new term that combines crowd and outsourcing. It means a way to get an undefined large group of people to do a task, right? And why is that important for this project?
IBM is a big data company, and we see crowdsourcing as an area where there's going to be a lot of data in the future and a lot of opportunities for people to participate in this interconnected network of data that we're building. And certainly with mobile phones, everybody has an option to participate in this. And we'd really like to see more people involved in crowdsourcing, involved in their environment, involved in data projects, because really, that's where we have so much expertise, is in big data problems, analysis. And so we'd really just like to get people involved.
My guest is Christine Robson. She's the creator of CreekWatch. She works at IBM's Research Center in Alameda, California, in their mobile computing division. Christine, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Brother Jack McDuff, Carlin Rufus, and Muddy Waters. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Kuva Coffee Company, Bounty Growing System, Sungevity Solar Home Specialists, and Invisible Structures, a sustainable paving company. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.